Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Medicare for all is a phrase we hear a lot on the presidential campaign trail, but not much about Medicare itself. And that's unusual. In past elections, Medicare has been a major topic because the program is huge, partially funded by payroll taxes and providing health coverage for 44 million older Americans and those with disabilities. But while Medicare does ensure these populations have access to health insurance, there are long-standing complaints about coverage gaps and concerns about rising costs. So today in The Exchange, we look at Medicare as it exists right now, what it is, how it works, and how it could work better. And of course, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests both joining us from D.C. Tricia Newman is Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and Director of the Foundation's Program on Medicare Policy. And Tricia, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Stephen Zuckerman, Senior Fellow and Vice President of Health Policy at the Urban Institute. And Stephen, a big welcome. Thank you also for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, both of you, I'll start with you first, Tricia. Give us your best one or two sentence description of what Medicare is. Obviously, it's huge. Obviously, it's complicated. But if you could just give us a brief summary of what this program is.
Okay, how about Medicare is a very popular national health insurance program that was established in 1965 that is administered by the federal government, available for people 65 and older and others with permanent disabilities without regard to their income or medical history, and it now covers more than 60 million Americans.
Good job. One sentence. How about you, Stephen?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the program covers hospitals, physician services, other institutional care, but it doesn't cover some services like dental care, vision services, and what surprises a lot of people, it doesn't cover long-term care. And that can be something that people need as they get older.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about what Medicare covers and what it doesn't, because you're right, Stephen, there's often some surprises when people find out that it doesn't cover things like dental or, you know, hearing aids and so forth. But a couple of things that you said, Tricia, Medicare is often called an entitlement program. So what does that mean exactly?
People become eligible for Medicare, but they have paid into the system throughout their working lives. So those of your listeners who know that when they look at their paycheck, they know that 1.45% of their salary goes right into Medicare. And so because people have paid in to the system, they are entitled to benefits when they become eligible for the program. And the program then is obligated to make payments. It's not a block grant program. It's not subject to annual appropriations. The money automatically flows because the government's obligated to cover benefits and people are entitled to benefits.
So once you start working, Tricia, you are kicking in a little bit, you know, all the way down the road.
Exactly.
And Stephen, something you said, Medicare is covering Americans over age 65, but who else does it cover? You mentioned people with disabilities. How is that sort of established?
Well, people who end up having disabilities that allow them to receive Social Security benefits as part of that disability are also eligible for Medicare after a short waiting period. And also people, you know, as the program evolved over time, people with end-stage renal disease who are on dialysis, maybe waiting for a transplant, are also covered by the program.
And Stephen, Medicare is often confused with Medicaid. So just clear that up for us, please.
Okay, well, Medicare is a federal program that's available in every state, and eligibility for Medicare is uniform across the country. Medicaid is a program that states administer with federal financial support, and the rules for eligibility for the Medicaid program can actually vary quite a bit across the states.
So Medicaid, go ahead, sorry.
And Medicaid is focused much more on low-income populations.
Right. So it's a state and federal partnership. The states have a lot of say over who gets covered and who doesn't. It's mainly for low-income people. Medicare, then, as you guys have both explained, and Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically everybody is supposed to pay in and everybody is supposed to benefit.
Exactly. And that's, you know, Medicare gets a little bit complicated because people do have some choices, especially if they're working after age 65. But basically, it's available to everyone who pays into the program and enrolls in the program.
And Tricia, you said Medicare was created in 1965. So what was going on at that time? What was the problem that Medicare was aiming to solve?
The main problem at the time is half of all older people in the country had no hospital insurance. And so the concern was that there were an awful lot of people who couldn't afford health care if they got really sick. And that was exactly what motivated Medicare at the time.
So Medicare started as hospital insurance. Just hospital insurance, Tricia?
No, but that was really the issue. That's the way people talked about it, framed the issue at the time, because the fact that was sort of the dry, you know, sometimes facts actually drive policy solutions. And the fact at the time was half of all seniors lacked hospital insurance. But when Medicare was established, it was established with both an inpatient hospital component, physician services, and all the other, most of the other benefits that it has today, other than prescription drugs, which was not a part of the benefits originally. I wanted to just add one thing, which is when we were talking about Medicaid a moment ago, the one thing that Medicaid does that's so important for people on Medicare is it is the main public source of funding for long-term services and supports, nursing home and home and community-based care. So for people who are on Medicare who have long-term care needs, Medicaid is actually fairly important, if they're low income.
I'd love to hear from both of you on this, but Tricia, you first. So what would you say the biggest difference between Medicare as it was created and Medicare now? What's the biggest difference between sort of Medicare 1965 and Medicare 2020?
Other than the drug benefit, which is new, I think the biggest difference is that Medicare has gotten more complicated with an expanded role of private plans in the program. People used to say, I can't wait to go on Medicare because it's going to be so easy. You just turned 65 and you went on Medicare and it was simple. We hear a lot about people being overwhelmed by the choices that they have available today with Medicare Advantage plans and prescription drug plans. And that just has made the system a lot more complicated. It's in some ways more opportunity to choose better plans or different plans, but there are also risks associated with creating a complicated program for an older population.
What do you think about that, Stephen? Medicare 1965 versus 2020?
I mean, I think Trish is absolutely right that the addition of private plans and the expanding role of private plans, some people are very surprised to realize that a third of all Medicare beneficiaries are not in the traditional Medicare program as it was designed in 1965, but have opted to be in these private plans. Less so in New Hampshire, but definitely that's become part of the program. And I think the complexity of Medicare has probably driven a lot of people in that direction, because when you think about, you have to sign up for Part A to get hospital services, Part B to get physician services, and Part D to get drugs. And then many people also opt to have supplemental coverage because Medicare doesn't pay for everything. It can get very complicated. So I think a lot of people have decided that these Medicare Advantage plans, which is sort of one-stop shopping, ends up being a better option for them.
Interesting. So, Stephen, how did that private element of Medicare get started? How and why?
Well, Medicare has historically reflected what was going on in the rest of the healthcare system. And really going back, so when it started in 1965, the system was largely a fee-for-service system where people, you know, went to the doctor, got a bill, and paid for each service separately. But by the 1970s, health maintenance organizations were growing, And I think, Congress, the policymakers decided that they wanted beneficiaries to have access to the same types of choices that you would have if you were, not in the Medicare program. But and I think that part of the program, the private plans, has always been a bit of a sideshow. It hasn't been a main part of the program until recently, probably in the last 10 or 12 years. There's been a lot of growth in people choosing these private plans because I think it's become more attractive. Payments for these plans have been fairly generous relative to traditional Medicare. So the plans have been available in a lot more places, and people have opted for them. So it's been a little bit of a surprise, I think.
That's interesting. Tricia, I'd love your thoughts on that, too, the growth in private plan participation in Medicare and whether that's been an overall benefit or not.
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Steve said. I think people may not appreciate when they talk about Medicare for All what Medicare looks like today, because in many parts of the country, and again, it's not so much in New Hampshire, but in parts of Florida, more than half of all people in any given county are in a Medicare Advantage plan, which is, by the way, sort of a term used to describe HMOs and PPOs that provide Medicare benefits.
Those are health maintenance organizations and
Maintenance organizations and PPO.
Preferred provider.
Thank you. Preferred provider. Okay, great.
Right. But these are operated by private insurers that receive payments from the federal government to provide Medicare benefits. I think in terms of what does it mean, is it a good thing? I think the jury is out on that. In some ways, the attraction of Medicare Advantage plans like HMOs is it is simpler because you don't have to do all the you don't have to get a separate supplemental policy or a Part D policy, and plans market extra benefits which are very appealing to people, like some dental benefits, some vision, some exercise facility fitness programs which appeal to people. Those benefits may appeal more to healthier, the younger part of the Medicare population. I think the issue that is important and still needs more discovery is how are these plans working for people when they get sick? Because there is some evidence that Medicare Advantage plans have somewhat higher disenrollment rates among sicker people, low-income people, people with disabilities. And that's really an important question to pursue. There are quality measures that are out there, but they don't really dig into how do these plans manage care well for people who have complex conditions. And this is a population that may start out healthy when they're 65, 66, 67, when they're really looking into what plan is best for them. But people, what we have learned is people tend to stay in whatever plan they've chosen. And that plan may not be best for them when they develop a certain condition. There are trade-offs involved in terms of can you go to any doctor, can you go to any hospital, because these plans by definition have networks of hospitals and doctors. So there are issues to be thought through. And while these plans sound relatively appealing, and in some cases are quite appealing for the various reasons we talked about earlier, they may or may not be the best option for people when they get sick. And there are issues about whether or not people can go back to traditional Medicare, which they can do, but they may not be able to buy a supplement if they are sick, because Medigap plans, which are Medicare supplements, are they don't have the same guarantee issue protections for people with pre-existing conditions.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And so people might get stuck and not know about it. And unfortunately, we're hearing more and more cases like that.
I see. So when you're younger, first signing up for all this, it looks great. But if you get older and sicker and have, some health complications, it might not be what you need. Stephen, do you want to jump in on that? And then I'd love to fold in some comments from our listeners that are already coming in. Go ahead, Stephen.
So I think one of the issues that is still to be determined is exactly how comparable patients are treated in Medicare Advantage and in traditional Medicare. I mean, at this point, I think the data that's available to really understand what types of services people are getting in Medicare Advantage plans is really not as extensive as you'd like it to be. I mean, so we did a recent study looking at beneficiaries who need home health care or who use home health care, which is certainly a covered benefit in traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage. And we're finding that there's a, not dramatic, but a significantly lower rate of people using home health care within Medicare Advantage than the traditional Medicare for comparable types of patients. And we're also finding that the amount of time people receive home health care is shorter within Medicare Advantage. So the obvious question is, well, is Medicare Advantage providing services more efficiently, or are they potentially, you know, skimping on services that that beneficiaries need? And, you know, at this point, it's a new enough phenomena, this movement to private plans, that it's still an open question as to how well, kind of long term, this is going to the private plans will actually serve beneficiaries with significant health needs.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, lots of questions coming in from our listeners. So let's go to them. And then I have a bunch more questions for you both as well. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Trish and Stephen, let's go to Jill in Harrisville first. Hi, Jill. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 71 years old. I'm on Medicare. I have a Medigap and a Medicare Part D supplements. And I have modest savings for a boomer. Now that I'm sort of semi-retired, I'm still working maybe two-thirds time. But what I would really like is a 100% Medicare option where I'm already paying a premium for my Medicare Medigap policy, and I would rather pay that money to the government and get 100% Medicare coverage that would also include long-term care. And I could see what would happen to me if I go the way my father did. In my mid-80s, I start having TIAs, and I end up spending the last year of my life in a nursing home.
Yeah.
Now, the way the system is right now, I would lose all my assets and not be able to pass anything on to my son, and I would and that extra cost, once I went on to Medicaid, would hit the state government. And Medicaid, I know, is a budget buster for state government. I was a state rep for 3 terms, and I would like to see Medicare completely take over that long-term care and wipe out that Medicaid burden for the states. This would help standardize the health care that seniors receive across the nation. And in case, you know, at some point a senior has to move closer to their children who are 2,000 miles away, and
yeah,
they can still be assured of getting the same nursing home care if they need it.
Well, and Jill, I'm going to jump in here because we're heading into a break. But when we come back, Tricia and Stephen, I'd love your thoughts on the many points that Jill raises. The idea that, you know, Medicare sounds like you sign up and you're all set. There's sort of this ease, this feeling that you're all taken care of. But then, as Jill points out, well, no, that's not the case, and there are still some pretty scary financial challenges. So I definitely want both of your thoughts on that after a short break. Thank you so much for the call, Jill. You can give us a call as well. It's 1-800-892-6477, or send your questions in by email, exchange at nhpr.org. You can also comment on Facebook or tweet us. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, with all the talk about Medicare for All in the presidential campaign, We're looking this hour at Medicare right now. Send us an email. We'd love your questions about the program, how it works now, how it might work better. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. You can tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. Helping us out this hour, Tricia Newman, Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and Director of the Foundation's Program on Medicare Policy, along with Stephen Zuckerman, Senior Fellow and Vice President of Health Policy at the Urban Institute. Both of them join us from D.C. And Stephen, I'd love to throw Jill's concerns to you. We talked to her just before the break. She sounds, you know, like she's got some major worries about Medicare not providing everything that she'll need as she gets older, having nothing left over to give her son, having to spend down her assets, and having to end up in the county nursing home.
I think, unfortunately, that's a very common problem, and it's a very big problem within Medicare, and it relates to the fact that Medicare does not cover long-term care, does not cover long-term support services, and that has been left to Medicaid, and Medicaid is a program for people with lower incomes and very few assets. And, you know, a lot of people, when they're in the situation that they will need care in a nursing home, the nursing home will very actively make sure that they're going to be eligible for Medicaid, because nursing home care can be so expensive that it's really unlikely that most people, you know, in middle income ranges with the modest savings, as Jill pointed out, would be able to afford to pay for themselves to be in a nursing home long term. So this is actually one of the areas that many of the proposals that are focusing on Medicare for All is looking at as an enhanced benefit, adding long term support services to this federally funded national health insurance program that would be Medicare for All.
And, so long-term care, Stephen, right now that's not included, even though that's what a lot of people are going to need.
That's absolutely correct. That's probably, in terms of the services, the expensive services that are not covered by Medicare, that may be the biggest one.
Let's take another call. This is Tim in Portsmouth. Go ahead, Tim. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Tim. Go ahead.
So I'm 67. I am a Medicare booster. So I want to just go over briefly why I have really positive feelings about Medicare. Number one, I'm not chronically ill. I'm still working. I'm still active. And number two, I have heard that it's complicated when you get into the Medicare Advantage programs and supplemental programs and all that. So when I was first offered Medicare, I just got Part A and Part B, which was very simple to do. And the monthly premium comes out of your Social Security check automatically. You don't have to, I actually had to send it in for a couple of years because I didn't collect Social Security right away, but I took Medicare as soon as possible. So my story is this. I go to Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital in Lebanon, the most expensive hospital in northern New England, or at least the best hospital in northern New England. And in August, I had a major operation, and it was $55,000.
Wow.
It took a while for me to get my bill, but when I got my bill, my copay, what I ended up having to pay was $1,300. On a $55,000 operation, which I thought was outstanding. And here's the thing about Medicare. Not only was this, is it simple and easy for me, and at this stage in my life, it's covering my medical expenses very, very adequately. When I go to the doctors, I pay the general practitioner, I pay $13 as a copay on a regular doctor's visit. And I have yet, and I talk a lot. I'm out in the world working, and I talk a lot with senior people, because in my trade, we're all senior people. And I haven't found anybody that has
had a problem.
Let me jump in for a sec,
because it's so interesting to hear from you. And there's a lot to unpack from this call. And Tricia, to you first, please. So $55,000 operation, A $1,300 copay. Tim is understandably very happy with Medicare coverage. What do you pull out of this, Tricia?
Well, Tim is not alone. People on Medicare are generally very, very satisfied with the coverage that they get. Often people who are buying their own insurance before they turn 65 are paying quite a lot in premiums and often have very high deductibles. So by the time they get on Medicare, they're quite relieved about the coverage that they get. It sounds like the $1,300 it was a deductible, which is the hospital deductible. And Tim, I don't know if you have thought about a Medigap policy, which you might want to do for even more protection, and the drug coverage too. But people with Medicare generally have good coverage, and I'm delighted to hear that it's working for you.
Well, it's interesting. So, Stephen, it sounds like when it comes to hospital procedures, Medicare does a good job. The problem comes in with other stuff that, frankly, people are more likely to need, like dental care, glasses, all that other stuff. So I'd love your thoughts, too, on sort of what Medicare covers well, Stephen. Clearly, operations is one of them. And what Medicare doesn't cover so well.
Well, Medicare, you're right. Medicare covers hospital services, physician services. If someone needs to go to a skilled nursing facility or a rehab facility or have home health care after a hospitalization or for some other reason, Medicare covers that very well. What it doesn't cover, and many people end up paying for out of pocket, is either vision services, dental services, hearing aids, and of course, as we talked about before, long-term care and long-term support services that that many people need. One thing I would point out to Tim is that the hospital bill may have said $55,000 on it when he looked at it, but it's unlikely that Medicare paid the hospital that much. Medicare tends to set rates for hospital care, and the beneficiaries don't see that, but hospital bills sometimes look a lot bigger than the hospital payment that is made by the Medicare program.
How much do you think, Stephen, hospitals jack up the cost for Medicare patients, knowing that, hey, the federal government's going to pay for it, so why not charge as much as possible?
In terms of Medicare patients, I don't think hospitals have that much discretion at all.
I see.
Medicare really does set the rates that it's going to pay, and it varies those rates across the country based on the costs of nurses' salaries, the costs of rents in an area, but the hospitals don't really control what they're going to receive from the Medicare program. They may lobby a little bit to get those rates higher, but they don't have the same ability to negotiate with the federal government that they do with commercial health insurance plans.
Wow, Tim, I'm glad you called. And let's go to Brennan in New Durham. Hi, Brennan. Go ahead. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Hi there. So I'm 21 years old, and my grandparents are enrolled in Medicare. And I've had a lot of conversations with them about concerns I have about the solvency of the program going into the 2020s and 2030s. Now, as an active taxpayer and having, this payroll tax of, I believe you said like 1.5% or something like that, taken out of my paycheck, I'm keenly aware of the fact that it's very unlikely come 2060, 2070, that most of this fund is going to actually be, there's going to be enough in the fund really for it to pay for itself. So I'm seeing kind of in a negative, so these great benefits that the previous listener who called in, Tim, had described sound great, but then you realize the fact that my generation, Gen Z, and a lot of millennials too, are going to be in the process of paying for all these very generous benefits for the oldest generation. And I kind of have the feeling that's a little screwed up, because going into the future with $20 trillion in national debt, I really doubt with our interest payments that a lot of us in the younger generations are ever going to see these benefits. Unless there's some massive tax hikes and we actually cut spending significantly, these entitlements, even like Social Security as well, they're very nice for the oldest generations, but I'm
doubting I'm ever going to see them.
Wow. Brennan, I'm so very glad that you called. And I've got two Gen Z kids, so, you know, I hear your frustration. Wow, both of you. How about you first, Tricia? You know, there's Brennan, and he hears about the great benefits Tim is receiving, and he says, okay, nice for you, but doubting it's going to be there for me. What do you think, Tricia?
I think it's a good question, Brennan. I'm glad you raised this. There is a financing challenge facing Medicare. There's the nation has an aging population, and really there hasn't been a lot of conversation about how will we pay and who will pay to provide health care for aging and older Americans. And Congress itself hasn't really focused on this in many years, which is unusual because Medicare financing used to come up fairly often. There are a number of ways to look at the financing of Medicare, and one of them is something called the Hospital Trust Fund, which is solvent through 2026, I believe. That's a number that's helpful in that it's a signal that policymakers need to pay attention to either spending or financing, and that is something that has been done in the past. I mean, I can remember when the government actuaries were saying that Medicare will run out of funds to pay full benefits in 2001.
Oh, really? And so we've heard these predictions before.
We hear these predictions annually, and we have now gone beyond the years in which they have made dire predictions. And there are actions that can be taken to strengthen the financing of the program because there is a commitment to people, and you are, Brennan, paying in a payroll tax with the understanding that it will be there for you. And it's a fair question to ask policymakers, how will this country decide to pay for people? Because truthfully, if the government's not doing it through the Medicare program, then it falls back on people. And it's highly unlikely that individuals will be able to afford the costs of health care on their own. So some sort of serious discussion needs to take place about how we as a nation are going to finance care for an aging population.
Stephen, what do you think? I'd really like your thoughts, too, because this is a fundamental point that Brennan is raising. And Brennan, again, thank you. Older listeners may think, hey, I paid into this. I'm owed this money. You know, this isn't a free handout for me. I've been paying in all these years. But younger listeners are thinking, yeah, I'm paying in right now, but I highly doubt it's going to be there when I'm old. So I'd love your thoughts too, Stephen.
Well, you know, as Tricia points out, I mean, this is not a new problem. I mean, the actuaries estimate how long the money available to the trust funds will be, you know, will last, and they do that every year. And historically, these predictions have always been met with policy changes when the issue becomes quite dire. So when the program is facing a very short time horizon for solvency, policymakers step in and make some changes to the financing. I mean, one of the changes that was made a few years back was to raise the limit of income that got taxed. So Social Security taxes are taken out of income up to a certain limit of income. I think it's a little around $120,000 this year. But Medicare now, because to improve the program solvency a few years back, that tax comes out no matter how high your income is. So people earning $300,000 a year may not be paying any Social Security taxes after they exceed the limit, but they're still paying Medicare taxes. That, combined with the fact that what providers get paid can be controlled by the federal government. Providers are not always happy about it, but there are changes that are made both on the revenue and the cost side to keep the program solvent. And historically, that's what's happened. Now, how long that can continue to go on and exactly how extreme some of those policy changes may need to be, that's an open question that people will have to debate. But there's no question that I think there's a strong commitment at the federal government to keep the program solvent and keep it available for people well into the future.
So let me make sure I have this right, Stephen, and maybe this will make Brennan feel a little bit better. So, Stephen, there's a cap on the income level that that gets charged Social Security taxes. Above a certain level, you can't impose Social Security taxes. But with Medicare, that is not the case. So on super high income folks, the government has said, look, you got to kick in more for the Medicare system. Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly the case.
And since you mentioned providers, Stephen, do providers have to accept Medicare, or can they say, no, the reimbursement's not enough, we don't want these folks?
Well, it's a voluntary system, and providers don't have to accept Medicare. Now, hospitals are quite unlikely not to accept Medicare patients. I mean, Medicare beneficiaries represent a very significant portion of the of a hospital's patient load, and they're unlikely. There are physicians who will say that they don't want to accept Medicare, but even that is much more unlikely than, let's say, physicians who are not willing to accept Medicaid patients. So it's not a requirement that physicians accept Medicare, but a very large majority of them do.
Well, and given the size of the elderly population, that's a lot of customers that they would be denying themselves. Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Well, thank you again so much for those calls. And I'd like to share a couple emails. Deborah in Concord says, our family of five have four different medical plans. Excuse me. Deborah says, I recently signed up for Medicare Advantage because of the extra benefits, but now I'm worried for the reasons that have been brought up on this program. One of my daughters is permanently disabled, and she has been shuffled around to different coverage, which at one time left her without coverage. It took about 40 hours of my time to get it all straightened out. This is only one example of the problems we've encountered over the years. I've also had to keep track of my elderly parents' plan with dementia. I've spent hundreds of hours over the past 5 years dealing with health insurance issues. Deborah, I am so sorry, and that is so frustrating and so draining, Tricia, to just deal with all that. Given that the population of elderly people is growing in this country, does Medicare have the staff, the resources to help people navigate it so that they don't end up like Deborah, spending hours and hours and hours on the phone?
Well, there are two issues. One is staff, and the other is sort of the system.
And complexity.
And, you know, the complexity. So Medicare operates a 1-800 number, and Medicare, there's something called state health insurance programs in every state, which are set up to give people advice and information. But the system itself is complicated, and there are issues involved about what is and is not covered. And sounds like Deborah's dealing with all sorts of issues that have to do with Medicare and non-Medicare. I mean, that caring for an aging parent with dementia, as anybody who has done that knows, is tricky, and a lot of the services that would be helpful are not covered. And that's a concern in the Medicare program that Steve talked about earlier. And then with respect to people with disabilities, her daughter with a disability, that's challenging too. And I'm not sure if her daughter's on Medicare, but there are a lot of issues. And once you go on Social Security disability, there's a waiting period for Medicare. There's a 2-year waiting period, and people have to figure out how to fill that gap.
All right. Got another question on the complexity and possible efforts to make it a little less complicated for people like Deborah. Deborah, thank you for the email, and good luck to you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're finding out today about Medicare, how it works, how it might work better. Again, we'd love to hear from you. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, the future of large-scale solar in New Hampshire. That's Thursday morning, live at 9. This hour, with all the talk about Medicare for all in this presidential cycle, we're looking at Medicare itself, how it works today, and what the concerns are, and we've been hearing from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. www.medicarefortheaging.org or call 1-800-892-6477. Joining us from D.C., both our guests, Stephen Zuckerman, Senior Fellow and Vice President of Health Policy at the Urban Institute, and Tricia Newman, Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation and Director of the Foundation's Program on Medicare Policy. And just before the break, we were talking about, once again, how complicated Medicare is. Tracy sent us an email. She says it's like stumbling through the dark and then just waiting to see what bills come through. And Stephen, to you first, what efforts are federal administrators making right now to make it less complicated?
Well, I mean, I think the problem that people have is that they go to the doctor, they're not quite sure what the program, what the services are going to cost and what their co-payments are going to be. And I mean, I think the system right now is administered by a lot of private contractors around the country processing claims. And I mean, my sense, and Tricia may have a different take on this, is that it's probably no more complicated than private health insurance. It might actually be a little bit simpler because you're going through a single administrative system. But I mean, I think that there aren't a lot of changes that I'm aware of in terms of administering the program and processing of claims to make it simpler.
What about assistance then, Tricia? Is there a one-stop shopping place where people can go to get help navigating this? It's complicated.
There really are a couple of issues we're talking about. One is choosing a plan, and I think we've talked a lot about how complicated that is.
Sure.
I think once people have Medicare, whatever plan they're in, it's not necessarily so complicated. There are sometimes when people want to appeal decisions, and Medicare actually sends a letter that says, here's how you would do that if you've been denied a claim and you think that's unfair. But in general, the default is people have their insurance, it gets paid for. They may have a copay if they don't have a Medigap policy, but in general, they don't. I think the real complication is in choosing. And again, where people can do is call 1-800-MEDICARE. If they're not sure how to handle a billing problem, or they can call their local SHIP, the state health insurance and assistance programs, if they're trying to figure out which plan they need.
Let's go to another caller, and Joanne is calling in from Hooksett. Hi, Joanne. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm 66 and just went on traditional Medicare. I worked in healthcare my entire life, and I want to know when Medicare will switch over to a wellness model, such as the Affordable Care Act did for private insurance. It's still on an illness model, including an annual physical. Your annual physical is not covered.
You know, this is a great question, Joanne. And Stephen, if you could sort of first elaborate on what Joanne is talking about, a wellness model versus an illness model. I think most people know what that is, but I'd love your thoughts there.
I mean, I think what Joanne is getting at is sort of giving people maybe greater incentives to engage in healthy behaviors, you know, exercise, diet, and the annual physical that Joanne talked about would be covered. So, I mean, I think that that's what she's getting at, and it's true that Medicare, traditional Medicare, doesn't have those kind of incentives. But it's also not clear to what extent those incentives have much of an impact on private health insurance costs, even when they're available.
Interesting. So even when wellness incentives are available under, you know, regular health insurance that anybody might have, it's not clear that people really take advantage of that. Stephen, is that what you're saying?
People may take advantage of it, but it's just not clear exactly what that does to improve their health in the long term.
Wow. So like weight loss, smoking cessation, all those incentives, we're not really sure how much that shakes out and makes people more healthy.
Yes, and to what extent they actually lead to people quitting smoking and losing weight and keeping it off.
Wow. Joanne, thank you very much for the call. And to Langdon, where Kate is calling in. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I'm piggybacking on the man who called in about the $55,000 bill, and he was pleased with how much he had to pay. I just recently got quite a large bill. I'm 72. I'm on Medicare, but not on supplemental. And the total of the bill, I just added it up, the total that that the hospital could have charged was $8,224. The amount that Medicare allowed was $559.
Oh, wow. That's a big difference.
So, yeah. And so I only had to pay $118 for what could have been, although my understanding from a friend who's a medical coder is that $8,000 is the highest that they could possibly charge for those procedures. So I, as he said, I'm really pleased with how little I have to pay. But I do wonder, as the population gets older, how hospitals will continue to be able to afford to continue to provide the services when Medicare pays $559 out of a possible $8,000.
Wow, this is a great question. And it's sort of similar to what we talked about with Brennan, Tricia, but with a different angle to it, a more specific angle. And I really appreciate the call. Kate, what do you think, Tricia?
Well, I think the $8,000 figure is a charge and not necessarily a true cost. So that's something, one thought that I do have. Medicare, there is a sort of a way of measuring how well or how appropriately Medicare is making payments, and they use the term margins. And Medicare margins have been declining, so the hospitals are not making so much money. But the more efficient hospitals seem to be doing better than what people think of as the less efficient hospitals. But one thought that I do have that I think is also coming up in some of the big larger debates is that private insurers are actually paying a fair amount more on average than Medicare pays for the same service. And there have been a lot of studies done that have looked at how much more private insurers are paying. And one of the issues with people struggling, and this is not exactly a Medicare issue, it's really just a general issue about healthcare costs, is are private insurers really paying too much? And what is that doing for healthcare costs for people in our country? And there is interest, and candidates have been talking about ways to sort of bring down private insurance payments so that they come closer to Medicare payments, which would still have hospitals operating profitably, maybe not as profitably as they do today, but it would lower price, which is really sort of the key issue in driving up healthcare costs in our country, in a way to make healthcare more affordable for people with private insurance.
Really interesting. So, Tricia, just because the hospital says, you know, we think this procedure, Kate, should have cost around $8,000, Medicare says to the hospital, we think it's $559, and here you go. That's all you're getting from us. That is really a big gap. And again, it raises the question that I asked earlier, how much are hospitals inflating these costs in hopes of just recouping as much as possible? Tricia, you want to grab that one? Or Stephen?
I'll come in and grab that. So the $8,000 charge shouldn't really be thought of as what it costs the hospital to provide that service. It's what the hospital, it's the price tag that the hospital puts on it. And sometimes, and I know this is can be hard to believe, when you look at data from hospitals, those charges can sometimes be 3 and 4 times as high as you might estimate the actual cost of the service. So it can be very deceptive looking at hospital charges and equating those with what it costs to provide the service. And it's really, I think, something that a lot of people don't understand when they see a hospital bill. It's just another complication within the system. And whether or not hospitals could accept that $559 for every patient that's receiving this service, is a legitimate question to ask. But right now, private payers, commercial payers, are probably paying more than $559. And there's kind of a balancing act that hospitals are doing in this, in a healthcare system where you have different types of payers, paying for different different types of patients.
So, Tricia, that raises sort of a meta question in my mind. How does Medicare, as it exists today, affect other parts of the healthcare market, from drug costs to how doctor's offices are run to, you know, what I pay with my private insurance? What's the impact of Medicare on the rest of the system?
The impact is enormous. And what we have seen is that private insurers have used Medicare as a model in establishing the way in which they make payments to physicians and hospitals, although sometimes they end up paying Medicare plus somewhat more. They often use a similar structure. So Medicare, it's a huge factor, and it's too big a part of the system to not have a big impact. It used to be that Medicare was no big deal in the drug industry because Medicare didn't pay for prescription drugs. But now Medicare, something like 30% of national spending on prescription drugs. That's another example of how Medicare can come in and really make a big difference in an industry.
And has Medicare's coverage of prescription drugs, which started in the mid-2000s, Part D, this was much celebrated, Tricia, how much of an impact has that had on, again, the drug prices that the rest of us pay?
Well, first, let me just say Medicare, the drug benefit, has had a huge impact on the cost that people on Medicare pay.
Sure, and to their benefit, largely.
To their benefit. And so I don't want to sort of skip over a really huge impact of the Medicare drug benefit. In terms of what other people pay, I'm not so sure. They're really different systems at this point. And it's complicated for Medicare, because while Medicare has been very successful in lowering the cost of prescription drugs and giving people insurance for their drug costs, relative to what was going on before, drug prices are continuing to rise. And so there are still outstanding issues in terms of what Medicare itself is paying and how those costs are now projected to rise in the future, and what people who take high-cost medications pay for their prescriptions. So there's the drug benefit, just in terms of Medicare, has done a good job, and the so-called donut hole is closing. If people have heard about that, that's great. But there's a lot of work still to be done.
Here's an email from Elizabeth who says, basic Medicare is sliding scale based on your earnings of 2 years ago. And to not grow broke paying deductibles and copays, et cetera, you need a good Medigap plan. And both of you have talked about, you know, it's often surprising for people that Medicare doesn't cover everything. Elizabeth says that coverage costs real money. Okay. But having to suss out the best deal for a plan for that and the best plan for drug coverage, which is also expensive, and seems to cover whatever it wants at the moment, tiers of coverage, high deductibles, copays, and apparently still the donut hole, and the following year to have to suss it out all over again, change a pharmacy, switch insurance companies. Elizabeth says, after a while, it feels like a big shell game played by the insurance companies, all working together against us. Elizabeth says, just raise our taxes, go to single payer, and be done with it. Elizabeth, thank you for writing in. Stephen, what do you make of that frustration that people have at times, not everyone, obviously, with Medicare?
You know, I think you can't get around the fact that it's a complicated structure. I mean, people have talked for a long time about simplifying the structure, even of traditional Medicare, not even Medicare Advantage, going in that direction. You know, not having a separate Part A and Part B choice and Part D, and then supplemental coverage. I mean, there has been some simplification over the years in supplemental coverage, where there's a certain number of types of plans that insurers have to decide to offer. But in terms of, you know, the sliding scale premium, you know, for people with higher incomes in Part B, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts in this system, and there's no question that Medicare could be, the structure of Medicare could very well be simplified. But you know, there's been a lot of debate over that over the years, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of political momentum for that to happen.
So a couple terms have come up this hour, and I just want to make sure that they're clear. So traditional Medicare is what, Stephen? What's the sort of best short description of traditional Medicare?
A traditional Medicare is the part of Medicare that existed, you know, back in 1965, that pays for hospital services through Part A, largely physician services through Part B, and drug coverage through Part D, and not you know, and not through a private plan, but through a claims processor.
A government contractor
who processes claims.
And then Medicare Advantage is what Tricia described earlier, Stephen. It's sort of a little simpler. Everything's in one place, but you have to maybe follow more rules under staying under a certain network of providers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Advantage? Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. Where there will be a specific network of providers. You can go out of network in some of the plans, not all of them, but you know you may be incurring some additional costs.
And then supplemental coverage is extra coverage for glasses, dental, stuff that people need when they get older, especially. Is that correct?
Well,
Stephen?
Supplemental coverage can be for that, but it's also can be to cover the co-payments and the deductibles within traditional Medicare. And, you know, one thing we haven't really talked about very much that can add to the cost is the fact that traditional Medicare does not have an out-of-pocket limit on what people are required to pay. And that can be a problem for people who are incurring, you know, very high expenses, even with Medicare's lower prices. So, you know, in the Affordable Care Act, people are limited to a little over $7,000 a year in what they might have to pay out of pocket. But traditional Medicare doesn't have that. Medicare Advantage, however, does have that as part of that program. So that's just another thing for people to keep in mind.
Tricia, last very quick question for you. We started out talking about how presidential candidates are talking a lot about Medicare for All. What do you want them to say about just regular old Medicare?
I actually think one of the great things about this camp, the focus on Medicare for All, is that it's bringing back attention to Medicare. And I think Medicare always needs ongoing work and improvement. And I'm glad this conversation is moving forward.
Well, it's been great to talk to both of you. Thank you very much for helping us out. Tricia, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having us.
That's Tricia Newman, Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Stephen Zuckerman, good to have you too. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much. We enjoyed it.
Stephen Zuckerman, Senior Fellow and Vice President of Health Policy at the Urban Institute. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.